in my opinion, the only opinions that matter are the ones that we have of everything around us. Like, I don't know of how, like,
did you just say all the opinions that matter are all the opinions that happen?
At this point, he goes back to Yeongsoon, and he's still, like, needing to get a bunch of information.
Okay.
And so he's like, I need to talk to your mom. And she's like, if you want my mom to get you to tell you the full story, you have to convince her that you are like a child.
Milk mustache convincing bedtime story time.
Yeah.
Is what I call it. Okay. So he eats cookies, drinks milk, lays down, kicks his foot up. It's very cute. They all start laughing. She starts to decide to tell him the story. Now we're, sorry, let's go back to the shower where Story has been like, this entire time. She's like, she's like, she's worried, but like, what is she going to do? She's been sequestered to the shower, and she has been, by the sister of M, been told the ear touch, truth and tell, powerful human.
So basically what she says is Story is not allowed to go ahead and tell all this information. So Vic's sister says, I used to, you know, I couldn't tell on my friends, but my mom said that if I pulled on my ear or, you know, touched my nose, then I wouldn't really be telling on them. And then she does this cute thing where she's like, I know it was cheating, but it made me feel better. And so that's how she coaxes Story to kind of give information about the different people that they need. There are different characters that they kind of have to gather. The guardian, the guild, the healer.
Then the last one is interpreter or symbologist.
Right. Someone who interprets meanings from the universe. Is this the time where they said, and you'll know you're on the right path because everything will come together?
I'm sure it's part of that. But what happens is Heap is like, got it. And he jumps at it and he's like, oh no, I know a writer. And he goes to the critic who is like, there is no originality left in the world.
Right. It's a very stereotypical, like, critics, just people who, and this is actually a fair criticism of critics, where they have to produce so much content for a movie that they're not given enough time to, like, watch a movie, let it sink in, rewatch a movie. Like, for myself, I like to think that I mean, outside of the case of Bolero, I like to think that for movies that I've never seen before, I try and watch it three times. There's the initial watch.
Oh, yeah.
There's the note-taking one where I'll sometimes pause and make notes and everything.
Okay.
And then there's the third time when we generally watch it together. I mean, on movies like this, I don't do that because I've seen it and I've already kind of formed my opinions over the years. But it's nice, like, having that initial reaction, taking time to actually, like, think about the reasons why you like it and the reasons why you don't like it. But then also sitting there and watching it a third time as like, I'm just going to kind of tie everything up into a neat little bow. And I don't think critics are really given the opportunity to do that. If they really want to kind of take that time.
Oh, rather than just like the initial observation that it feels like a lot of critics do.
Yeah. I mean, that is valid criticism of critics. But it comes across as just being like obsessed with your hater, you know? The critic pretty much says that a lot of these characters in the movie are characters that would have already been introduced. And the critic kind of runs down like, this is what the guild would be. This is what the interpreter would be. This is what the guardian would be. This is what the healer would be.
Yes.
This is the Matthew Lillard Scream moment.
That's fair enough, honey.
I'm going to tell you all of the elements of the horror movie right now.
Yeah, except that kind of happens later. More specifically later.
This is kind of a red herring to that. Yeah.
In that, I mean, I've got some thoughts about the critic. I'll wait about.
Okay. You can have your opinion whenever you want. So Heap goes to the critic and is like, what should I do? What do I need to do to assemble this guild? The critic is like, blather, 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 gives him bad information. And my list from here is bad, which is half a page of notes, and you should be thankful. So what ends up okay, so like, let's skip all of that because it's all wrong, really. we get, okay, so what we end up having is the crossword guy is insinuated to be the interpreter symbologist, right? The guild is the stoner group of guys that we met earlier who were debating Jimi Hendrix They were debating who was better than Freddie Mercury. And I will fight you in the comments. So then they were like, who's the guardian? We assume it's Heap. Who's the healer? We're like, hey, it's the grandma who's got a butterfly on her, you know?
Because they had mentioned that, you know, sometimes the healer is around butterflies or like animals that are attracted, soft-spoken people, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's important for later on.
So they meet her in the shower. They make all these predictions.
He brings all these men that she doesn't know into the shower where she just has a robe or she just has a towel around.
She's naked.
And he sees her like a child. Sorry.
I love how the sister of M is like, or Vic or whatever you want to remember, is like, he's the voice of God. He's the prophet. Over the guy reading off the crossword predictions, who's like, oh, a soiree. Oh, sonorous. Oh, we need a loud party to distract. Maybe we can just be big and around her and we get her to the water while everyone else is listening to a band. Like, it's all very conjectured. You can kind of see him like working out the thought process of it. And then they're all like, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And then the sister who's like, yes, yes, prophet, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So they've all agreed to throw this party. They're all working it out. They're like, oh no, it'll be about 13B or whatever. And then, they show her on the couch and they gam up. They go from feet, leg, knee, thigh, up her body. And she's on a walkie talkie. She's in Heap's apartment.
Right. And he's like, I have to go ahead and I want to like kind of, if I'm going to be the guardian, I want to try and fight this grunt.
Right. She turns to him, says, you'll need a mirror. Which is why I threw a mirror at you.
You did. I like come down and Naomi's like watching it at this moment. And it's like, you're going to need a mirror. And I was like, I just need a crowbar. Anyways,
you can only see it in a mirror.
Facing
backwards.
He is unsuccessful at so the whole thing about the scrunt is that if he stares at the scrunt, the guardian can hypnotize the scrunt, mm-hmm, and make him back away. But it's not working for Heap.
He doesn't back away. He, in fact, we're talking about the grass wolf, which is what I've always ever thought of it in my head.
Mm-hmm.
He tries to confront it. It moves forward as opposed to back. And then she's like, he's moving forward. He's like, yeah, moving forward, not moving backwards, staying still. She's like, run. And he's like, weep. And then Faber rescues him. The critic rescues him because he's about to get eaten by the scrunt.
Mm-hmm.
And then Faber looks at him, not him, but in the direction of him. And then everything stops and he's just over on his side with a chair. And he's like, okay, so are we starting the party now? Because they're like, they call it Baby on the Half Tip.
This is a serious movie, right?
No, I never said. Lydia Malcolm, I have never said that this movie was supposed to be serious.
This is a housewarming party for the critic. The new guy.
Oh, no, hold on a second. You gotta whoosh, whoosh, on that guy.
On what guy?
On the fact that it's a housewarming. Whoosh. I mean, like,
It's in quotes. It's
Yeah, it's like
a soiree.
He's, you know, the critic's really touched by it. He's kind of presented as being this jaded asshole. And then he's like, wow, this entire apartment complex is having a party just for me. I feel kind of special.
But
that's great.
No one knows his name. They only know him as 13B.
Yeah. I mean, Heap knows his name.
He knows his own name.
Yeah.
And that's the name of our metal album. So Heap is walking past whom I refer to as Cloister Guy. Doesn't have a better name?
Oh, is it the guy who's sitting in his room,
mm-hmm,
and Mr. Heap's like, oh, did you get an invite for the party? And the guy just holds up the invite.
Hold on, I got paper noise. And then Cloister Guy. Cloister, I only say because he's like in his apartment all but one scene. He goes, does man deserve to be saved? And Heap is like, yeah. I was like, hell yeah, Heap.
It's Mr. Leeds. Is the character's name.
Yeah, Leeds to Heeds.
Played by Bill Irwin. Bill Irwin was one of the characters in, what's that FX Marvel show? The Legion. He was in Legion. It was very good.
Okay. Awesome. I don't remember. I never watched Legion. Okay. So M. Night Shyamalan predicts his own death. Fantastic.
Yeah. So this is the moment where he's sitting on the toilet next to the shower and he's talking to Story and he's like, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the story and like, but I'm thinking like, why doesn't this kid, you know, come and talk to me? Why doesn't he, you know, reach out and see me and everything? And she's like, oh, that's because you die.
Not mad about it.
So he becomes a martyr for his.
Does he though?
Well, I mean,
not in the context of this movie.
In the context of this conversation, he says there's a lot of things in this book that are going to make people mad.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like when she talks about his death, it's like he's getting killed for his ideas. In the context of the conversation, there's nothing direct.
You're not wrong.
There's
not wrong.
Nothing direct. But when you're writing a book or a story, you do not, like Chekhov's gun.
Uh-huh.
It is not just about the gun that's brought up at the beginning. It's not about the stuff brought up at the very beginning of the story. You do not bring up anything in that story unless it actually is working to tell you part of that story. So why would they have a conversation about this writer writing a book for that is going to make people angry, and then he dies. For me, maybe I'm wrong, maybe with other people it doesn't invoke it. For me, it invoked this idea of martyrdom. He's going to die for his ideas.
I feel like he's gonna. Hey, let's be real. I'm super down for M. Night Shyamalan dying.
I'm not. I mean, nobody should be dying for their ideas.
He can come and yell at me and autograph some shit. He can yell at me about it.
Okay.
I'm okay with it because I feel like at this point he as an author, producer, director is like, I've made my mark, and if nothing comes from me from this, I may inspire someone, you know.
But how many times has he probably heard this is the movie that will undo your career, like this is it for you?
So much. Here's what I feel about this moment as he predicts his death, as my notes say. I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit. That's what's nice about it, is that every time we've encountered him, and until the end of the movie, I get it. Like, I'm there. I'm like, oh, look, the director, writer, producer, right? I'm like, oh, look, there's the writer, producer. But it is only ever sprinkles on the cupcake that is this film. So, like, hey, do your best. But, like, my focus has never been on you. It's been on Paul Giamatti. It's been on Drana Phenomenitis. Drynal hematitis.
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Hell yeah.
I'm glad you understood. I thought she was just like, you know.
Having a stroke. It's fine. I can't. If you got three names and you're not a serial killer, I'm not going to remember your fucking name. Okay. So what I like is that we cut from this scene where he's like jerking himself off, which is, okay, like, look, it's his fancy film. He can do a little bit. Okay. But then we cut to Heap is writing again. He's writing in his journals again. And Story already said that his words are beautiful. And although he's not the writer of the movie, like the fact that he's like been inspired to start to create, we're looking at the gears starting to grind again. And I think that's kind of beautiful. Like, I don't give a shit about M. Night. I do care. This is my favorite M. Night. But like in terms of like storytelling, that was very like, you know what I mean? Like blow it out your nostril the other way. We don't care. He's writing. Farber then, this is the part where Farber walks into the party and he's like, hello, hello, how are you? Thank you for so much for showing. And they're like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah. So the party is going on.
It's all around the pool.
It's a pool party. Their whole plan is they're going to have this party, and then there's going to be a band on the inside, and everybody's supposed to go inside when the band starts playing. So that way she is alone when the eagle comes and gets her.
Yes. And she exposits to Heap that when things are going right, everything's going to line up.
Mm-hmm.
The world will line up and show them they're doing everything the right way.
Right.
And she lets him know how insecure she is. She says, I'm clumsy and they all make fun of me. And he encourages her, as I recall.
My note here is, she is a Disney princess.
My note is, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
Is an allegory for being gay, as what the Seattle Men's Choir told me 1 year.
Okay.
I can't hit the notes for it. Yeah. Okay, so now we're all taking posts. Oh, who do you identify? Who are you? Are you the band? Are you the sister? Are you Heap? Are you
the mirror?
Are you the mirror that the sister's holding that she eventually drops and fucks all the shit up?
She does not drop it. Someone runs into her and it flies out of her hand.
What about the stoner? Are you the stoner who pukes and then fucks everything up?
Or the stoner who goes ahead and like, they've been working all night. I don't know why they're not calling them
in
there.
You used up the battery, says Heap on the walkie-talkies uploaders.
Mm-hmm. Are you the scrunt?
So he goes to find something. Who does Heap go to find? Maybe he's helping find the mirror. I don't remember.
I'm not entirely sure. I feel like Heap is...
maybe he's checking in on the band that hasn't started. Well, they should have started by now.
So I think he tells someone to go wave at them and...
Because, he ran out the batteries.
Yeah. But maybe he's going to get more batteries.
He points to two stoners, like, you stay here right now.
Right.
But then another stoner shows up and... Or a random guy pukes. Yeah. And so they walk him to go make him feel better, but that's obviously where their deficit.
Yeah. And so the sister is, like, keeping an eye on the area where Heap saw the scrunt, and she's doing it with her mirror. Uh-huh. But then someone runs into her, uh-huh, mirror falls out of her hand. Uh-huh. Everything's just going to shit.
Yeah, because the universe is not lining up because they're not doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
You know what is amazing about this scene? Can I tell you?
Go for it.
I'm going to tell you. His stutter comes back, and that's how he realizes that she has been compromised.
Mm-hmm.
He realizes that the stoners are not protecting her by looking at the grass to make sure that the scrunt does not come back.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, he stutters and he's like, oh shit. And then he turns and he pivots and he runs and he finds her being dragged away in the grass, which is the worst way I can think of being anything. Could you imagine any worst way of anything?
It is kind of one of the worst ways to kind of get dragged to your doom. But because of the fact that Heap's here and he's, mm-hmm, you know, important on some level, mm-hmm, the scrunt can't, you know, take her away fully. And so he grabs her up and he takes her up to Vic's apartment. And,
okay. So one stoner is in charge of garbage down in the lower decks.
Okay, so that does happen because there's like, you know, they're like, oh, they took her up to the apartment because, uh-huh, she got attacked. And, uh-huh, and like, I like the fact that these guys are like...
Her legs are fucked.
Yeah, but like, I like the fact that the guys are like, the stoner guys aren't like, you know, being pervy. They're just being like, yeah, she's really concerned. And they're like, they're super invested in this.
But the stoner, another stoner guy who all have names, like they're stoner, stoner goatee, stoner smoker, stoner whatever. It doesn't matter. Someone is taking out the garbage in the bottom floor, and he gets called up from the bottom floor, but he leaves the basement door open.
Right. I thought he went through the basement door, and he opens it really wide, uh-huh, and then as it's slowly shutting, that's when we see the scrunt go through the building.
I think he pinned it open. I don't remember exactly. It was open. And he went, I think he came through that door, and then he went up the stairs to the right,
okay,
our observational right.
Okay, because I think the door had shut, but I could be wrong. So
he gets in through an open door.
That's the important
scrunt
point.
The mm-hmm scrunt, ladies and gentlemen, and variations thereupon, or also my preferred term, entities.
Mm-hmm.
Entities.
Right.
The building has been compromised.
Right. And so they take Story up to the apartment. The lady who's supposed they think is the healer,
mm-hmm,
she's like, you know, kind of holding her and kind of praying a little bit. And then we see the scrunt hunting through, looking for him. And he comes to. Is this where we see Vic and his sister, or just Vic in the laundry room? He's, you know, like washing some clothes.
I don't know. What I do know is that the healer ain't healing and the interpreter ain't interpreting. And that my notes literally say Jen Hart's Henry Wright. I don't remember why.
Jeffrey Wright is the interpreter in the scene. And he actually makes a very good point of, you know, you're telling all of us who we are and nobody can really tell you who you are.
Fair enough. Okay. But we do cut to what was my original... I will let you go.
Oh, I was just going to say, that is more heavy-handed M. Night Shyamalan stuff. Saying, like, nobody can tell you who you are. Like, he has been pigeonholed as the director that has the surprise ending. He's trying to tell everybody, you can't tell me.
You can't tell me shit.
I'm just for all of that, I'm going to make a movie that, like, is...
lasts you into this next scene is what you mean. Because the critic is acting like he knew everything, is now drunkenly walking down a hallway. He's like, is the bathroom working on this floor? Right? But then...
The scrunt shows up.
I love this. I love... He's in the... I love this scene so much. Lydia, I love this scene so much.
Okay.
Okay. I don't have to own it, though, because I want you to be in it with me. Okay, so the lights are out on the far end. He flips the switch. They don't work, right? And he's like, do the bathrooms work on this floor? And he's walking down, and he walks and he walks and he walks until he sees the scrunt. And then his monologue, I wish I had Googled.
Okay, so... his monologue is pretty much, he sees the scrunt, he starts to become terrified, and he says, he pretty much is talking about himself, where this is the point in the movie where the unlovable person mm-hmm. is given an opportunity to make an escape. But yes. He goes, and what's going to happen is I'm going to turn around, make a rush for the door, and close the door as you are just inches away from getting me. And then he turns around and dies.
Yes. He does manage to pull off the lovable quip that endears him to the audience, but he does not manage to survive the scene. Is he the only one who dies?
The critic is the only one who dies.
M. Night, M. Night, M. Night, so, M. Night, M. Night, M. Night, M. Night. Ow!
So this is a clear representation of how he feels about the critics who, you know, kind of pigeonholed him. Is that what he's trying to say?
Yeah, I'll exposit at my applaud, but like he's been so rigmaroled that like the only way that he could possibly have pulled himself out of it was to be so very, very direct. He's like, here's my critic.
But he wasn't, but yeah, okay, so he was direct, but he ultimately went back into, you know, doing movies that have these twists in them. Old had a twist. I mean, I never saw Old, but it had a twist.
I haven't seen it, but cool.
There was the one with the old people. There was a movie that he did with some old people, and there was a twist in that.
That's not Old?
No. No, Old is the one with people going on the beach. But then there was...
Invited or...
The Visit, I think.
I thought it was The Invited, but it's...
The Visit. But despite the fact that he didn't want to be pigeonholed as, you know, the guy of a thousand twists, when he got through with Wayward Pines, it seems like, you know, a couple of his movies still had that twist in it. And it's like, if you don't want to be painted up as this guy with a twist, like, make something that's... So Jim Carrey was, like, for all his faults, and I don't think he has any, like, problematic faults, but I think in the 90s, we ended up getting really annoyed with Jim Carrey. I think that's a fair statement.
Not wrong. Go on. But also love him. So go on.
Right. So he kind of got out of that role of the funny guy. And he took a serious bent towards making more serious pieces. And he did Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, I think. Oh, that was Steve Carell. Sorry. Which one was that? He did a few serious movies. He also like did some painting. I think he found Jesus.
He wanted to be, no, I don't know if he found Jesus, but he wanted to be the next Jackson Pollock for a while. Was Steve Carell and Jim Carrey in that?
The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Maybe Steve Carell was in that too. But
Little Miss Sunshine is what I was thinking. Oh shit. Little Miss Sunshine was what I was thinking. I'm sorry. 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 Sorry.
Right. And I mean, you do see him going back into the 90s role with the Sonic the Hedgehog movie. And people are really enjoying that, too.
I kind of really enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
Because he's his silly self. But also, I've seen him in serious roles, and he can do it.
It feels like there's he wants to say something here, and he says it, but it's very, I guess, heavy-handed is the term. So, you know, like with the critic, like the twist with the critic is that the critic knows how it's going to end, but then... the twist is that it doesn't actually happen. what the critic thinks is going to happen to him.
Yes. Yeah. The critic gets chomped. And I think that's what I liked it because, I mean, the thing about it being a critic, mm-hmm. right? And I've been criticized poorly by high school children. So I'm not a really good judge of critics, but also I will judge every critic.
Also, you are a critic.
I am.
You are a critic. We are critics.
I'm a movie reviewer who leaves open-ended sides for whatever the fuck you decide yourself.
We are critics.
Okay, fine. But also, you kind of made me lose my point. Oh, no, I lost it completely. Oh, my God.
Hold on. Critic, the twist that the critics had always talked about. Yeah.
Okay. So the great part about this scene, and we will rush through the last 2.5 pages of my notes, I promise you. The thing about being a critic is that you get to go on after the thing that you're criticizing is done. You know what I'm saying? So most of the time, like, say you're looking at some critical blockbuster like Titanic or whatever. Siskel and Ebert, God bless them, God rest half of them, or both of them. Oh shit, both of them. Okay. So God rest and bless both of them, right? They look at this masterpiece and they're like, well, and they middle finger it all the way, right? Well, after the movie has well been done and has been digested by the masses, their criticism lives on, right? As do they. They are not defined, right, by what they have criticized. They are a person who gets to continue to be an authority well past and beyond the thing that they have judged. You hear what I'm saying? You feel what I'm saying?
I get an aspect of it, but mm-hmm. but there are people who do not like Siskel and Ebert, and it's not just movie makers.
I can't remember agreeing with Siskel and Ebert ever.
Here's the thing about critics. Huh. Like, the critics didn't like Venom, and the critics didn't like Venom, Let There Be Carnage. And I say boo to you.
I like both of those.
I love both of those. Those are great. And like, if you want to say that there are things that are wrong with it, okay, go ahead. You do you. But like, opinions, in my opinion, the only opinions that matter are the ones that we have of everything around us. Like, I don't know if how, like,
did you just say all the opinions that matter are all the opinions that happen?
No. sorry. Okay. Opinions only matter to those who have their own opinion. Like, my opinion matters to me. Does it matter to you?
Yes, because we have a podcast.
Okay. So let's say that we have some random person out there. My opinion matters to me. That random person, are they going to necessarily care about my opinion? Probably not. Because, like, how often do you look at, like, award shows? Those are nothing but super fancy people saying
forward propaganda bullshit.
That's all people who want to go ahead and have opinions about movies. And I learned a long time ago, award shows, and I do not sync up with our opinions. And at some point, I'm just sort of like, okay, so people are going to have opinions about things. And unless your opinion is, you know, maybe like hoarding resources that could be given out to people in order to make sure that they're not suffering in their life, or, you know, your opinion is on the political state in a country that, you know, maybe isn't as far gone as you like to think. And your opinion on that is to such a degree that you feel like you need to overthrow the government.
I mean,
I'm going to have words about that. But when it comes to art, if you are a person who loves this movie and I'm a person who doesn't, I'm just like, we'll voice our opinions. And then that's it. And then we'll both move on with our lives.
This is the thing. We get to move on with our lives. Guess what happens to Mr. Farber?
He doesn't.
That's the whole point. That's what M. Night is saying. It's like, in this movie, I fucking finite you.
But it seems so petty.
Yeah, that's what's really funny about it.
So the writer, director, producer,
yeah,
who also puts himself as being a very important game piece mm-hmm. on this world has also said that the people who criticize him are pretty much unimportant.
Yeah. But also, you have to, for this, take into context that he has been shat on ever since he did a flippy, fancy twist in every movie after The Sixth Sense.
So he's been shat upon? Has he been pigeonholed into this idea
yeah.
that he's a twist guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what would have been a twist?
Huh.
If this movie was campy and didn't take itself so seriously.
It doesn't. I mean, it takes itself seriously enough. But then, like, there's...
Percentage of the time. How often do you think that this movie takes itself seriously?
This movie takes itself seriously 40% of the time.
I would say this movie takes itself seriously 90% of the time.
Wow. That is a weirdly different percentage. Yeah. Jen, go.
I'm a very important person. I have a story.
I wish you were a waiter.
I think it doesn't know if it needs to take itself seriously because it originated as a story to his two kids. Yeah. How serious do you take the stories that you tell your kids at bedtime?
Not at all. I'm garbage to children. I'm like, hey, look, dragons, stealing cars, eating motorbikes, wearing tennis shoes, having relations with harpies.
I see the stories that I tell myself at night to make me go to sleep is very important because it means I'm not staying up at night wondering about this and that and the other thing. So the stories that I see stories as like, unless you are very obviously not tongue in cheek, then you are taking yourself seriously.
This is my favorite rant of all time.
We've been here for a year.
3.5 years. Hey, guess what? That we got the interpreter wrong.
Yeah, it turns out it's a kid who prophesies through cereal boxes.
The dad figures it out. The dad of the kid figures it out.
Prophecy with cereal boxes.
I'm super down. He says, hey, we need a ceremony. We need the guild. He's like, hey, guess what? It's seven sisters. Fuck those stoners right out the door.
Yeah,
and then he's like, we also need the no secrets guy and the regarded opinion guy. So the sisters of the Hispanic guy from earlier, he only has five. So we also need Young Soon, and we also need a sister of M. Night, whose name I should have written down, but I'm a dick.
Anna.
Is her character's name Anna?
Do you want the actress's name?
No. Yes.
Do you remember before when it was Jeffrey Wright interpreting everything and Anna was like, he's speaking the words of God. And Everybody's like, ooh. And then Jeffrey Wright tries to motivate his son to do the job, saying, really, really good job. And everybody's like, shh.
Yeah.
He's not allowed to motivate his son, but everybody else can motivate him. It's a weird little.
That's fine. Children don't need much motivation. They need just a little nudge. So the seven sisters are the five ladies of that one guy we met in the beginning, plus Soon Young and Anna.
Correct.
Okay, so No Secrets Guy is the lady who was just like, he has gifts, but don't tell him I told you.
Right, he has absolutely no secrets because his wife tells all of them.
All the time, don't tell him I told you. And then regarded Opinion Guy is who I've referred to as Cloistered Guy, who is?
Mr. Leeds.
Mr. Leeds. He's been in the apartment longer than anyone, including Mr. Heap. And he's the one who Heap goes to for advice. So he pulls him in, and now they're set up for the ceremony described by the kid.
Right. And this is the ceremony that's supposed to bring Story back from her comatose state, because she's still, her legs are still shredded, and the healer lady is, you know, kind of on them, is still holding her. Everybody puts hands on her, and they're all praying, hoping that she gets better. But then the kid comes in, it's not working.
And that's not up yet. The scrunt is in the laundry room, so he's in the building still. The band finally starts playing.
Yeah, there's rain coming down and it forces everybody to go inside.
Okay, so then while they're assembling, that's when little dude comes in and he says, the healer was she, but then I went back and I looked at my cereal boxes. He is what I meant. He leads a ceremony of seven sisters with the man with no secrets and the regarded opinion guy. And then one of my favorites is Cleveland Heap starts stuttering all over himself. Not stuttering, Is he stuttering?
He's like, well, I'm pretty sure, like, when I saw the butterflies, it was on, there was a butterfly on you. And the old lady says, Mr. Heap, when I saw the butterflies, it was only because I saw you. So it was like, he actually brought the butterflies around. And so he's like, I can't do this. And like, everybody's like, you can do it. You can
Young
do
Sue
it.
Young Sue goes, shut up and try.
Okay, so Mr. Leeds and the No Secrets guy.
You're right, it's Mr. Leeds.
And the No Secrets guy, both of them are like, we need to get her to a doctor.
Yeah.
And that's when Young Sue is like, no, this has to, we have to do it this way. And like, Mr. Leeds is like, I wanted to believe, but I don't know if I can. And she's like, you've got to believe. And so
that's when Mr. Leeds says, and that's the regarded opinion guy, that's when he says, shut up and try, which is the regarded opinion, which is the thrust that Heaps needs to be able to start. He takes the position of the healer woman, who is now he's the healer man, and all of the ladies put hands on him, which like super church vibes on me, by the way. I don't know about you, but like hands on somebody.
Well, like this whole scene has a moment of like coming to God. Yeah, and it's heavy on the spirituality.
Yes. And so this is where Heaps starts saying everything he would say to his family, his wife and his children, if they had not been killed. He says everything he wished. He's like, I wish I had been there. I wish I could see your face. Your faces show me God. And I love you. And I miss you. And I wish you were here. And this is where my notes are like, I'm crying, you're crying, Paul Giamatti's crying, we're all crying.
I wasn't crying.
Yeah, but I wasn't crying either, but if I did, this would be the scene.
It was still a very powerful scene because Paul Giamatti is a very good actor,
yeah,
and he was able to convey those emotions very well. I think when I first saw this, this was the scene that was like, I love this movie so much because of the spiritual aspect. And then I found out later that Shyamalan went to like one of those Catholic schools, and like it really affected him. Like,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, at least that's what I remember it to be.
She gets healed. She's blonde now, by the way. Did you notice?
Mm-hmm.
Her hair is bleached from red to blonde, probably because of the dying thing. Everyone's been drawn in by the band named?
Don't know.
Silver Wave.
Okay. But there's also, doesn't it start raining as well?
It does start raining. So the sisters lead the way with all their like sticks and brooms and stuff. And then the wolf is inside and it's seeing them pass by. A story gets a moment with Victor and says, your sister's going to have like 7 kids, but I want you to know you're going to get to see the first 2, which I think is like compassionate.
Like at the beginning when you had mentioned that these ladies were in all white and there was like some darkness around them. It's kind of like that whole like she's been breaking the rules and conveying a lot of information when she shouldn't have. But even the Skrunt, you know, was, you know, breaking the rules and everything and being super evil. There was an element that makes you still wonder if Mr. Heap was the guardian because of the fact that the Skrunt still was very hesitant to be around her when Heap was around her.
But now, hey, I'm with you because we're at Skrunt confrontation number 3. So we know because of the previous interaction that Heap is not the guardian. And they're standing at the edge of the pool face to face as a whole thing. She looks behind his shoulder, sees the Skrunt coming. I say that Story's looking beyond Heap's shoulder, sees the Skrunt, is like, blah, blah, blah. And but then Heap turns around and he's like, blah, blah, blah. And then he turns back and the Skrunt isn't moving. And then he's like, guess who the hidden savior of this entire movie is?
Reggie.
Reggie. One side of his body, Reggie.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so Mr. Heap tells Reggie, don't move, just keep staring at it. And Reggie's like, you know, able to kind of back it off into the forest.
Yeah, with a pool skimmer or whatever the heck in his strong arm, which is hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
But guess who shows up right then?
The Tortugas.
They're Tortugas.
The Turtles.
Yeah, they're not turtles.
One of them actually is a Ninja Turtle. did the motion capture
for you, Lydia. Do you know this?
No. Oh, no, okay. No.
They're all grass monkey people.
Mm-hmm.
But then Lydia, Jen has a thing for you right now. It's a present to help us glide through the last 15 minutes of this podcast.
So the thing about these Tartutifs.
Tartukins.
Are you sure?
Turtles.
No. Sorry. I have Tartukins in my notes and I'm sorry. I'm sure it's wrong.
The Skrunt is digitally animated. Like, doesn't exist. These guys are head to toe, full body makeup, what kind of actors do we like that generally appear in full body makeup?
Are you saying that Doug Jones is one of these? The Doug Jones from Shape of Water? The Doug Jones from Batman Returns?
The one and only.
Yes.
And Pan's Labyrinth.
And Pan's Labyrinth.
Tartukian number four. Tartukian number four. That's Doug Jogan's for Jen. For Jen and for Lydia. And yeah. For me. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Lovely.
How did that increase your love of this movie by at least 1 point?
A half a point. A full point for Mr. Jones. That just makes me love him even more. So, like, I love everything he's in.
So the Skrunt gets dragged away the way that they were trying to drag away Story. And I think if she was going to die horrifically, they killed the Skrunt horrifically. And I am super down. And then also, because of that, Story is by the side of the pool with Heap, and they hug for the only time that really happens in the entire film. And Cleveland leans in and goes, "Thank you for saving my life." And then the eagle swoops in, Hell's Moving Castles, mm-hmm. a wing in, and then she's gone. And then it cuts to credits. But here's the part I want to say at this point. Earlier, when the critic was like, the romance I watched earlier was super predictable and they kissed in the rain, it was super stupid and there was nothing good about it. Paul Giamatti goes, "I feel like that was a symbol for a new start or rebirth." And the critic goes, "No, no, it's not." Right? But like, it super is in this film, isn't it? Like, right. he's moving beyond the trauma that had cloistered him about his wife and children. Right? And then it's over. And then it's critics. And then I wrote in my notes that Doug Jones was Tartutic number four. But then at the end of the credits, did you see what it said?
No.
It said, "To my daughters, I'll tell you this story one more time, and then you have to go to bed."
That is good.
That's the end of the movie. Like, that's the end of the credits, even.
Well, didn't you find the story, like the book, the storybook on Amazon, Jen?
Yeah, he did end up released on the same day that the movie came out. So
aww.
He published it, at the same time. By M. Night Shyamalan, illustrated by Crash McCreary, which is an excellent name.
Is it?
Okay. So this is, this isn't like the description that's like on the book or something like that. It says grades 5 to 8. This is from some site called The Book List, but it's on Amazon. "There are ways to know if they are in your backyard," reads the first line of Shyamalan's debut picture book, an effort as creepy, suspenseful, and flawed as many of the director's post-Sixth Sense films. Got a critic here. "They are sea nymphs called Narfs who reside beneath swimming pools and magically transform the lives of the humans they encounter. Moody, silvery scenes by film industry artist McCreary amplify the mystical qualities of the telling. Less successful are the book's puzzling elements, from the curious hieroglyphs appearing on every spread of the overzealous use of white space, which makes both art and text seem too sparse. The story is loosely based on Shyamalan's PG-13 rated film by the same name, and despite the fact that the book appears to have been conceived with younger children in mind, its sophisticated qualities make it most appropriate for readers old enough to see the movie. This will also attract high school film buffs and many adults who are curious to see Shyamalan's brooding creativity expressed in a new form." That's a copyrighted Jennifer Mattson, American Library Association. There you go. Would you like to know some Sean facts?
Yeah, please.
All right. Just a few to top us off at the end here. Director Shyamalan adapted Lady in the Water, originally a bedtime story, to his children. And he also, delighted after he discovered the unknown Cindy Chung, was shocked to hear that her agent demanded $1 million for her role in this film.
Hell yeah.
Knight was prepared to pay the SAG minimum $65,000, and they settled at $100,000. And under the credit, music score programming is the name Chris P. Bacon.
Fuck you.
Crispy Bacon, Mr. Frodo. Would you like an eagle to save you today?
What song did he do?
I don't know. It just says musical score programming.
Well, okay, look, separated from a lot of how we end these films, let's shocked and then applaud very quickly and then be done.
Sounds
how do you
good.
Feel? How do you feel about that?
We've been here for years, so yes, I'm all for that.
Under 2 minutes each.
Oh, like each. I'll just read mine. I don't give a shit.
Go for it.
My shocked moment is how, and we've discussed it a little bit, so maybe it's been answered, but my shocked moment is how M. Night was put in a position where he had to say, just let me tell a fucking story. He had to fight for it. He bit it. He shook it around a little bit. He was like, my little girl's, I assume, bedtime story is fine. And then he spat it out, and this is what we got. And I can't believe that he had to fight so hard for it. The end.
Valid.
Right. Do you feel like he had to fight for this movie?
I don't know. I don't fucking honestly know. But what I do feel like was this feels like the result of that conversation. You know, it feels like a response to a lot of criticism and how he got to finally do, how much was it? A millions?
72 million in production.
Yeah. And I know it didn't make the money.
Or maybe 70 million.
Yeah, but it didn't make the money. It wasn't 1.5 times the money.
I think that's a valid point simply because of the fact that movie studios are not just going to give you a bunch of money and say, like, here, go ahead and make this. He was probably like, Sixth Sense was a big hit. Studios were probably like, you have to keep doing that. You have to keep doing that. And so he did it again and again and again. He tried to make it his own. But ultimately, he had to work towards making the movie that he wanted to make. So I think that it's a valid point.
Thank you for that. What is your shocked moment?
The potential of this movie was overshined by Shyamalan's self-importance. That's all I'm going to say.
That's fair enough. I won't argue about that with you. Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I will say, and this is not in contradiction, he was very fine in this movie, and I kind of wanted to make out with him a little bit.
Shyamalan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jen, you're shocked. Got no flaws in this film. Thanks. We can move on. My applaud moment is...
to at least answer, even if it takes me a while.
Restart clock because Naomi got in there. All right.
That's being funny, honey. Please tell me your shocked moment.
I was initially shocked at the departure of this film from his other ones. But over time, that shock has gone down. Whereas Lydia had said, you know, like, especially more and more after the fact, some of these things I relate to other things. I'm kind of the opposite. Like, it was when it was fresh and it was like, Narf, are you kidding me? Now it's like
Pinky in the Brain, right?
Right. But Narf. But now, I mean, there's still enough distance from me now where it's like, just let him use whatever words he wants to use and I'll pretend they're a different word in my head and enjoy a little bit more because of that. So I was initially shocked at how different this movie was from his other ones before it. The end.
Okay, who wants to applaud?
I'll go first.
Okay, go.
Reggie!
Best part.
He's
best
only
part.
Ringing out one side of his body.
You see him at the beginning. He has a very specific trait. You see him at the end. He does. He's like, I don't know what's going on, but you're like, yeah, I'll go ahead and stare down this like grass wolf with a pull cue. I'll go ahead and do this, Mr. Heap, because I like you, and I've been working out one side of my body
for science.
Best part, Reggie, love him absolutely.
No debate. That is beautiful. Put that in a box. Put a bow on it.
Put it underneath the Christmas tree for next year,
Jen. Get it out.
So even though Bryce Dallas Howard was very...
I'm sorry, did you say Murph Murmur?
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Sorry, Murph Murmur.
We should all do it and just have it be done with.
Bryce Dallard Howard. No, that's still wrong. I tried that time.
Mice Mallard Ballard.
Bryce Dallard Howard.
Bryce
Ballard.
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Wait, are you just fucking with me? You're still fucking wrong. Bryce Dallard Howard.
Bryce Dallas. Like Dallas.
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Right.
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yes.
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Right. Okay, start over again.
I'm sorry, Jen, go on.
She's well, and maybe this is actually my shock. She is well underplayed. Like, there is very little for her to do in this movie. Except just look wet and scared. And I wish there was more of it because she's...
You want more wet and scared?
No, I want more of her. I want more development of her. I know it's like, it's a little meta to ask that the story is more developed, I guess.
Maybe.
So this is your applaud moment, right?
It My applaud moment is Bryce Dallas Howard in this movie.
She's glorious, really. Is it the gams? Are you just blinded by the gams?
No, because I don't feel like this was a sexy lamp opportunity.
No.
Oh, she was not a sexy lamp.
Not at all.
She played her point just as well and opposite of Paul Giamatti.
Agreed.
Yes.
And for the amount that she had to work with compared to Paul Giamatti, I think that's pretty cool. She was still able to make that character her own. I respect this woman in just about everything that she does. There are some Jurassic Parks in there somewhere. She's heavily involved in the Mandalorian and Book of Boba Fett series, and she is becoming more and more like her dad in a good way.
Who's her dad? Ron Howard. Fucking, we covered that. Go on.
Okay. Because we have covered Willow before, and Willow was a Ron Howard movie.
Yeah.
And now she's doing more directing stuff, and she's also been in, like, Black Mirror. So, just Bryce Dallas Howard.
Not wrong. And so, applauders, we've come to my applaud moment. The thing I like most about this movie is the unapologetic storytelling. And I will tell you why. The exposition happens. It doesn't hurt, right? We find out about all the characters, and then we find about secondary and tertiary and quaternary characters, and we don't feel weird, awkward, or like it's misplaced, right? They've been introduced enough that they can come back later. We've been introduced enough that we don't mind them speaking for themselves. I will also say that introductions aren't bad. Switching focus happens in this film without a lot of pain. Like we're like, oh, were you looking at that guy? Because you should have been looking at that guy. And we're like, oh, right, yeah. And we turn and we look and we don't feel that like ripping. Like we're not so connected to this character that we can't look at this next character, right? Unapologetic. They're like, story shift, go. And you're like, yes, audience member, I'm going right now. Paul Gio fucking Motti is part of these notes right here because he's a glorious character who I don't feel is like making fun of people with a stutter. He does a very good impression of a person with a stutter. I feel like if somebody was much more analytical than us, they could go through the scenes and be like, hey, is she present? Is he stuttering? Etc. Etc. That there is no classic romance in this film in any way. Like, no one has to make out. There is no sex. There is nothing but her gams between Uxt and the world. We got no boobs. We only get, like, silhouette of butt. We're not in a sexy place with this movie at all, right? Which is fine by me, because I get overwrought with a lot of it. Also, the final thing that I will say about this unapologetic storytelling, which is the thing that I love the most about this film, is that the bigger story happens outside of what we see. Right? We're talking about the blue world. Like, she's about to go back and become a queen and, like, start a whole revolution. M. Night Shyamalan is about to inspire a little boy to be, like, the second Hitler. I don't know how that works, but, like, it's going to be something big. We don't know, right? But
the second Hitler?
It just says a political leader who inspires a great deal.
Doesn't it say that he becomes president, though?
Yeah.
What was Hitler to Germany?
Right.
Führer?
I will admit in my notes, I jokingly said, and that boy was Ben Shapiro. Anyway, sorry. I didn't mean to go.
All to say that the bigger story happens outside of this, which makes this much more unctuous to me. It makes it feel much more like
personable.
Like I just want to sink my teeth into it because like if the bigger thing is that she becomes Madame Narf. I know it sucks and we can talk to M. Night when we meet him, but like she becomes this much more big thing that she's not quite ready for, but she's been bolstered by the fact that everything has been in place for her, you know? So like it all falls into place the way that's been predicted and it all comes into this beautiful conclusion and no one has to fuck to make it happen. Thank you, M. Night. I will take another. I haven't seen one yet. But I would like another.
Do you think that this was the beginning of his decline?
No, like, I just don't.
Was this peak M. Night Shyamalan?
For me, right now it is, but I haven't watched the new thing that we were going to watch later.
I've still got two left of the Unbreakables to watch, and the old and the, what was it, The Invited?
The Visit?
The Visit. I saw Devil, but he was just writer on that one. So, I've got a lot to still see. I think that this is probably where I stopped keeping up with it as much. Like, there was a time when I was like, oh, it's the new M. Night Shyamalan movie. I got, just like everybody.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So that was the same with me. And Last Airbender stopped that for me. That was very, there's reasons for it, but.
That's fair.
It was the happening for me.
That is not fair.
Mark Wahlberg.
Well, you can stop it at Mark Wahlberg, but otherwise.
The trees are going to kill us.
That had John Leguizamo, and he's great in El Canto. So let's just talk about El Canto. Or no, it's just Encanto. My goodness, Lydia, what is up with you?
Encanto.
Encanto. Encanto is how they.
Encanto. It's good. Anyways. I've watched it at least 3 times now.
Yeah.
Okay. So I feel like we've covered.
Mm-hmm.
We've covered. It was Jen meowing for the cat. Okay, applauders. Hey.
You made it through February.
Who gets to pick next?
Well, it's going to be in March.
It's you.
Applauders, I'm already sorry. But you're looking very good. Thank you for putting on those pants. They look really nice. Thank you.
Even if you decided not to listen with pants, that's okay too.
Hey, no pants is a valid choice, and we like that a lot. We hope that you get gentle correction wherever you need it this month.
Or that you're giving it.
Hey, listen to the bumper Jen's about to do. It's pretty epic.
It won't be epic.
Shut up, Jen. It's going to be epic.
I have planned for it not to be epic. I don't want it to overshadow, you know.
Oh, our introspective bullshit? Okay.
Until next time, this is Jen McQuaid.
This is Lydia Malcolm.
And this is Naomi. You know what you're listening to because you clicked on the thing.
That's the beginning of the thing.
Thanks for listening to Shock to the Plot.
Yay!